This is the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks on KQV with expert advice from CPA, attorney, and retirement and estate planning expert Jim Lang, best-selling author of Retire Secure and The Roth Revolution, Pay Taxes Once, Then Never Again. Now on air and worldwide, paytaxeslater.com. Now get ready to talk smart money.
Hello and welcome to this edition of the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. I'm David Baer here in the KQV studio with Jim Lang, CPA, attorney, and author of three best-selling books, Retire Secure, The Roth Revolution, and Retire Secure for Same-Sex Couples. Marriage has myriad benefits in addition to the less tangible factors like love and companionship. For the last year, Jim Lang has been working to quantify the financial advantages of marriage and writing about the findings. Today's program will explore some calculated perspectives on the value of marriage as we discuss two articles Jim wrote recently for Trusts and Estates magazine, a leading peer-reviewed publication for retirement and estate planning professionals, discussing retirement issues for unmarried couples. One focuses on optimizing Social Security benefits, while the other explains optimizing IRAs and retirement plan distributions. Stay tuned for an interesting and informative hour. So, Jim, let's start. Can you tell us a little bit about the magazine, Trusts and Estates?
Well, yes. Trusts and Estates magazine is a journal that goes to financial planners, estate attorneys, CPAs, basically high-end planners who are looking for the best information. Whenever you're in my position and you have some opinions backed up by quantitative analysis and you want to prove your assertions and you want people to believe what you are telling them is actually accurate, the best way to do this is to get something peer-reviewed. So, for example, if I was a physician and I had a new way to treat cancer, I would try to do a study, and then if it worked, I would want the study to be recognized by the profession. I would try to publish an article in the New England Journal of Medicine. The equivalent in the retirement and estate planning world is getting an article published in Estates and Trusts magazine. That way, when I start spewing statistics and how much people can save and things like that, rather than people thinking, oh, well, he's just talking off the top of his head or he might be wrong, I can now tell people, you can rely on this information because it is peer-reviewed, and they have their own review process that is, from what I can tell, pretty much in-depth, and they actually check the calculations.
And a lot of this grew out of research and calculations and numbers you ran for your last book.
Yeah, that's right. When I was actually doing the Retire Secure for Same-Sex Couples, I wanted to quantify the benefits of getting married for same-sex couples. So basically the premise of the book was, if you were a same-sex couple, and particularly if you lived in a state where same-sex couples and same-sex marriage was recognized, that you should get married for financial purposes. And I'm mainly talking about older couples where Social Security and estate planning becomes an important element. And when I was trying to let's say, gain recognition and publicity for the book, I ended up doing an interview for a website that is associated with Trusts and Estates magazine. They really liked the content, and they asked me to do an article on now, they didn't want to just limit it to same-sex couples. They just wanted to do it for unmarried couples. And they asked me to do the article, and I said, well, geez, given the amount of space you're giving me, I can't do that article. But if you give me enough space to do two articles, I can do that. One was Social Security, and one was on IRAs and retirement plans. So those came out within a number of months of each other.
One was August and November.
Yeah, August and November. So the first one was Social Security. And by the way, we got a lot of response from that. A lot of people went to my website and signed up, and it generated a lot of response in the professional community. And the article was basically for either same-sex or unmarried couples, and it kind of didn't differentiate.
Unmarried heterosexual couples.
That's right. That's right. So it's unmarried either heterosexual or same-sex couples versus married same-sex or heterosexual couples. And the biggest difference is that today you can have a unmarried opposite-sex couple get married in all 50 states anywhere. And in the same-sex world, then there are going to be a lot of states where it is not legal. On the other hand, we are seeing changes.
Almost daily, yeah.
Yeah, it seems that every couple of days, one more state is allowing same-sex couples to marry.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what this came out of. And what I was hoping to do today is to talk about some of the benefits and also some of the detriments of getting married for financial purposes. Now, I'm going to leave the love and the companionship and, let's say, some of the intangible benefits of marriage. I'm going to leave that for the sociologists and the psychologists. And
I'm going to rely on hard numbers.
And I'm going to rely on hard numbers and just try to talk about the financial benefits.
Well, do you want to start with the optimizing Social Security benefits one?
Yeah. Why don't I do that? But this is one of the things that I would say, because I wrestle with this issue. I'm not telling people that don't have a good, long-term, committed, lifelong relationship to get married for financial purposes. So I'm not, you know, trying to do a fraud or trying to, you know, make up marriages that don't exist. But let's assume that you are in a long-term, committed relationship, presumably for life, and the difference psychologically between being married and not being married is not so enormous that you have to go one way or the other. So this information really addresses the people that could go either way, or for people who are interested in getting the most. I think we have a call.
We actually have a call. This says John's calling from Oregon. Hello, John.
Hi, John. Yeah. Are you with us?
I am.
Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
Well, I thought maybe if you told us a little bit about your situation and your question, maybe we can be of some service.
That would be great. My partner and I are in a committed relationship. We are not married. We are strongly committed for the duration. We're both in our early 60s. And I'm interested in what you were just talking about in the differences in income, given whether we get married or not. We both, our situations, she and I both had reasonable incomes throughout our lives. We will have a reasonable amount of Social Security, each of us, starting soon. And we have a large portion of our assets in a retirement plan or IRAs. And so I'm wondering, the fact that we're not married, it sounds like that might cost us money.
All right.
I wonder,
well,
if you can address that.
Okay. I'm going to ask you some specific questions, but some things I think are confidential, and I'm not comfortable asking you for the radio. So, for example, I'm not going to ask you how much is in your IRAs or retirement plans. But
okay,
but to give you more specific advice, if you could tell me how old each of you are or what year you were born, then I can be more specific.
Yeah. Well, I was born in 1951, so I'm 63. She was born in 1954. She's 60.
Okay. All right. Why don't we take a look at Social Security first? Okay.
All right.
All right, let's first talk about a basic concept of Social Security, whether you're married or not. But let's assume for discussion's sake that you don't get married.
All right.
We all to we almost never want people to take Social Security before age 66. That's your full retirement age. That is what you would, let's say, they call the full retirement benefit.
Uh-huh.
And let's just take you for a moment. So if you take your Social Security, and let's say you're not married, at 66, and let's just say that that number is $30,000 or whatever it might be per year, you would get that much plus the cost of living, whatever is deemed, presumably for the rest of your life. This is just if you're single. If, on the other hand, you wait until you're 70, you would get an 8% raise every year for every year that you wait between 66 and 70. So that would be another 32% plus an additional 4 years cost of living. So that's the basic idea if you are single. And let's assume that you are not married. And what is your partner's name?
Her name is Marie.
All right. So let's say that you aren't married. I would probably recommend the same thing for Marie. Now, the downside of waiting is if you die young, then the fact that you waited means that there would be less money for you and potentially for Marie. But I think I'm going to show you that by waiting, you're actually going to end up with a lot more money for Marie. All right, so let's just go on the basic assumption, though, that the plan is to wait until 66.
Okay.
All right, for you. All right.
Okay.
Or I'm sorry, to at least start considering at 66.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you...
That's what I'm doing.
All right, now there is a technique called apply and suspend that I think will work very well for both of you. So here's what it would be. If you didn't get married, then let's say you each take a benefit at 66 or you each wait until 70, then each of your Social Security records would determine how much money you would get, and then you would presumably combine both of them, and that would be money available for the marriage. But let's say instead...
For the marriage, I think you said if we didn't get married.
That's correct. I'm sorry, for the both of you, assuming that you are combining finances.
Right, we are.
All right, thank you. All right, so let's say instead you wait until age 69, all right? When you're 69, Marie will be 66. She will be at her full retirement age.
Uh-huh.
Then you do something called apply and suspend, and this is how this would work. You would apply for Social Security,
but
then you
at
would
66.
Suspend... All right, now this is if you were married. The first case, you know, it's just two ships going along with no extra benefits. But if you were married, this would entitle you to do this technique called apply and suspend. Then at age 69, you would apply for Social Security, and then you would suspend collection. So what does that mean? You wouldn't get any money, but that would entitle Marie, who would then be 66, she could apply for a spousal benefit. Now, her spousal benefit will be roughly one half of what your benefit would be. All right? And that pattern for her continues between 66 and 70. So let's go back and say that your benefit at age 66 was $30,000.
Okay.
She would get $15,000 a year between age 66 and age 70. Now, here's one of the beauties of this. Remember I said that you get an 8% raise for every year that you wait. The fact that she is collecting on your record, she still gets the raise on her own record.
Uh-huh.
So really, that's kind of like 4 years for free. So if you...
Is she taking her Social Security at 66 while she's taking, well, I've applied and suspended, so she's taking her Social Security plus that $15,000?
No, she's just getting the $15,000.
And that's all, okay.
And that's all. So by the time she's 70, let's say she's collected 4 years of Social Security of 50, as a spousal benefit.
Yeah.
All right, $15,000 per year. Now, when she's 70, she applies based on her own record. But here's the thing. On her own record, that will be 32% higher than it was as if she had never taken a nickel. So that $60,000 is free. And in addition, for the rest of her life, she will get 32% plus the cost of living every single year. All right. Now, let's go back to you.
That, I'm 73 at this point.
You're right, but we missed a step.
Okay.
At 70, yeah. You then say, I want to start collecting. So you get the full benefit. The fact that Marie took on your benefit doesn't reduce your benefit at all. You get the entire amount. So, let's say when you're 73, you're collecting your full benefit, and the fact that you waited till 70, you're getting the extra 32% plus the cost of living. Marie, in the meantime, is getting just as much as if she had never collected a nickel before 70, which would include the basically what she would have received at 32% at 66 plus 32%. And then she gets that for the rest of her life. Now, part of the article, and it doesn't have your exact situation, but what I did in the article is I compared two people or two couples, and they were identically situated. And I actually took the extreme. I said, well, both start collecting at 62, which we don't recommend, and they don't get married. And the other couple does this apply and suspend at age 66, and the difference over time for that couple was $2 million. Now, the facts that you presented to me, the difference will not be that much, but it will easily be hundreds of thousands and maybe over $1 million if you live into your 90s. So the difference is very substantial. And here's the other thing about optimizing your Social Security benefit. It's kind of like longevity insurance. You know, some people say, oh, geez, I want to take the money at 62 because I want to make sure that I get it. Well, if they get it and they die, they're dead. They don't have a problem. You don't fear dying for financial purposes. What you fear is living a long time. So this is kind of like the cheapest longevity insurance you could possibly get. And I would say, I'd like, you know, if you don't get married, I'd probably want you to wait until 70. But the Social Security home run for you would be to get married, then have you apply and suspend at 69, Marie collect a spousal benefit at 66, she continues the spousal benefit till she's 70, then when she's 70, she collects on her own record, that includes the 32% plus cost of living raises, then when you're 70, you collect as much as if nobody had ever collected a nickel, and you're getting, the 32% plus cost of living raises, and that will continue for the rest of your lives. And if you live into your late 80s and 90s, it will, and again, I don't have the off the top of my head how much of a difference it would be for your exact situation, but it's easily hundreds of thousands, maybe $1 million.
I see. That's pretty amazing. That's an odd artifact of the tax laws, I guess, that this apply and suspend thing is allowable and it can work that way. It sure favors getting married when it comes to finances.
Well,
I have a question. Would it be beneficial? You said something like I could apply and suspend at age 69 and then take full benefits at 70. Could I apply and suspend at age 66 if I wish to?
Yes, you could, but here's the problem with that. When you're 66, Marie will be at 63. All right? If she starts collecting before she is full retirement age, she gets what's called an actuarial reduction.
Okay, yeah.
And that will hurt her A, for the amount that she can collect on your record, and that will hurt her for when she turns 70, even collecting on her own record. So,
right, I see. So the best thing is to do, as you just said, at 69 and 66, and then wait one more year, and then I would be collecting if I were had waited until I was 70. She will have been collecting. She'll start collecting the 15 or the half of my benefits plus her own at age 66.
That's exactly right.
I see.
All right,
well,
now
it's something to consider.
All right, now here's one thing. Here's what I don't want you to do. I don't want you to say, "Oh, gee, we're going to get all this money when we're 69 or 66 and 70, or 67 and 70." So let's live very frugally now, knowing that we're going to get a lot more money later. I would say it's a better idea to spend at least as much as you would have if you had been collecting, so you're not depriving yourself of anything. It's kind of like if somebody was going to give you $1 million and it was guaranteed at age 70, you could spend some of that money before age 70, knowing that even if you go into your portfolio some, that you, that money would be restored when you're 70. So this isn't a suffer now and live it up later strategy. A guy named Larry Kotlikoff wrote a book called Spend Till the End, and that was his basic idea, is you do want to do this apply and suspend technique, but that doesn't mean that you live like a pauper until you actually start collecting.
You would say that I should take from our other assets what we would otherwise have been getting in Social Security during those years. Is that it?
That's exactly right.
So, okay, well, that's a little more comforting, because I was planning on getting Social Security starting at age 66, and Marie starting to get hers 3 years later, and in order to have these benefits that come with applying to spend, you were saying we wouldn't be getting that money, or I wouldn't be getting my money at least until I was 69. But you're saying during those 3 years, I should take that, well, you used the number $30,000 out of my other assets and make sure I spend that as a way to insure against, dying at 71 and being sorry about it.
That's right. Now, in your case, dying at 71 won't work out that well, but sorry about that, at least not for you. You mentioned that you and Marie both have good earnings records. Let's say, all right, if you had a situation where, let's say, let's use the old sexist paradigm, where the guy has a really strong earnings record and the spouse does not, the other benefit of you waiting till 70 is at, if you die, then Marie would get the higher of her benefit or your benefit. So let's say that Marie was a stay-at-home mom, or she didn't have a strong working record. All right. I would still want you to do everything that I said, but then when she turns 70, she can still collect half of yours, which might be higher than her own. And then if you predecease her, the fact that you waited till 70 to get that higher amount will not only be for your benefit for the rest of your life, but let's say you do die at 71, and let's say she hadn't had a strong earnings record, then she would get that increased amount every year for the rest of her life.
Well, that's pretty interesting and pretty good, but I have to tell you my situation. I think our earnings were comparable.
Okay. All right. So that's fine. So what that would mean is the death benefit wouldn't be all that important in your particular situation. But for whatever it's worth, the fact that she gets to increase her record from age 66 to 70, even though she's collecting $15,000 a year from your record, is going to certainly boost her financial security. So even if you do die young, she'll still have the increased amount for her.
I see. That's pretty interesting. I'm taking notes.
Okay. This has been great, John. Would it be possible for us to take a break and then address your IRA questions after the break?
How long of a break?
2 minutes.
2 minutes. Okay.
Okay. We'll be back to you in 2 minutes. Thanks.
Righto.
This is the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring expert advice from CPA, attorney, and retirement and estate planning expert Jim Lang. More coming up right here on KQV. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all your financial needs, turn to the Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill. For more information, visit online at paytaxeslater.com. Let's talk more smart money with CPA, attorney, and retirement and estate planning expert Jim Lang.
And welcome back to the Lang Money Hour. Listeners, if you're interested in either of these two articles that Jim's been talking about, you can call the Lang Financial Group at 521-2732, and they'll be glad to send you a free copy. That's 521-2732. Remember to ask for Amanda.
John, are you still with us?
I am.
All right, and if you have to roll, I understand, but you've been a great guest. Should we talk about your IRA now?
I would like to do that. I just want to make sure I understand one thing about Social Security.
Okay.
All that you talked about, all those benefits that come with apply and suspend, they are just not available unless we get married.
That's correct.
Okay, I wanted to double check that.
That's correct.
Okay, so, let's talk about my other retirement assets.
Okay, now I think it's too personal to ask you how much it's going to be, but why don't we use a nice round number like $1 million?
Okay,
so let's assume that you have $1 million in your IRA.
Between us?
No, let's just talk about yours. All right. If you died tomorrow, is she the primary beneficiary of your IRA and retirement plan?
Yes, she is.
Okay. So you want to provide for her in the event that you die early, or even if you die late, you want to provide so that she is taken care of for the rest of her life?
As best as possible, yes.
Okay. All right. So that is, let's call it your primary objective. And now, if you both live a long time, at least in the IRA world, while both of you are alive, there are not going to be huge differences between getting married and not getting married. On the other hand, you said you were 3 years older than Marie, and men typically live 7 years less than women. So actuarially, without questions of your health and longevity, etc., it is very possible that Marie will survive you by 10 years. So let's assume that that does happen, and let's assume for discussion's sake that at your death, whether it's at 70 or 80 or whenever, or tomorrow for that matter, let's assume for discussion's sake that the balance in the IRA and retirement plan, when I say IRA, I would include 403B and 457 and 401K and SEP and KEO, etc.
Oh, okay.
All right. So if you combine all that stuff, that would be $1 million.
Okay.
All right, so let's take two examples. Number one, you die and before you get married and you leave her your $1 million. Now, she has her own retirement plan. At some point, she will have her own Social Security, and then she has some of her own financial resources. And typically, we would recommend that somebody in her position only take money from the amount that she inherits from your IRA only as she either needs it or the government is going to force her to take it. All right, if she has her own resources, then it doesn't make sense for her to take money from your IRA earlier than she has to, because if she has to take a lot of money from your IRA and she doesn't even need it for her spending, then the amount that she withdraws or has to withdraw is going to be subject to income tax. So that will totally and forever reduce the amount of money that she will receive and that she will earn interest, dividends, etc. On the other hand, if she can leave that money in a tax defer, that is, it will eventually, she'll eventually have to pay tax on it, but she can pay taxes later, she will be significantly better off.
Okay.
All right.
And that's if we're not married either way.
All right. Right. If you're not married or married, I basically want her, assuming she can afford it, to take as little from your IRA as possible. Unfortunately, for you, if you don't get married, the amount that she will have to take on your death from your IRA is treated much, much differently than if you were married. If you are not married, she will have to, you know, let's say you died tomorrow before she is 70, or any time before she is 70. She will be forced to take distributions and pay tax on it, even though she might not need the money.
Oh, I see. Even before she turns 70, she's forced to take money and pay tax?
That's correct. This is if you don't get married.
Okay.
All right. And the way you would calculate how much she has to take is you would calculate her life expectancy, which would be found in publication 590, and it would, let's say roughly 28, a life expectancy of 28 years. So she would take 28, divide it into the balance, and that's how much she has to pay tax on. Next year it would be 27, divide into the balance, that's how much she has to pay tax on. The year after that, 26, divide it into the balance, that's how much she has to pay tax on, etc. That's if that's current law if you're not married. Now there is
I didn't know that. That's a lot of tax.
It's a lot of tax. Now it gets worse. There is pending legislation that is supported both by Obama and the Republican Congress and we believe the Senate. And if this legislation passes, she will have to pay income tax on the entire IRA that is distributed to her within 5 years of your death. That's right, because she isn't a spouse. So this new law would only apply to non-spouses. So let's say you died with $1 million in your IRA or your 403B, etc. Within five, if this law passes, and we think it's a much better than 50% chance that it will, and very likely before your death, she's going to have to pay tax on income tax on $1 million within 5 years of your death.
Wow.
So that's going to push her into the, you know, probably the highest brackets. Even if we try to spread it out, it's still going to be a couple $100,000 a year. She's going to probably have to pay roughly $400,000 in taxes. I'm talking about income taxes. And then the amount that is left, that $600,000, that's going to be subject to income. The earnings and dividends and capital gains on that is going to be subject to income tax every year.
I can't believe the Republicans would allow this.
Well, I happen to think it's a terrible idea because this is hurting the middle class guy. This is hurting the guy that has a couple $100,000 or maybe $1 million or $2 million in their IRA. It's not hurting the guy that has $100 million and has a small IRA. This is hurting the middle and upper middle class guy who has worked hard. I mean, if you have $1 million in your retirement plan, you obviously worked hard and saved regularly, and you want to provide for your family after you're gone. But
right, well, yeah, it just seems like you're paying taxes twice, what you just described.
And worse, you're paying it quickly.
Yeah.
All right, now, let's take that same scenario, but let's say that you got married and then you died. All right, if you got married and you died and you left her $1 million and you died before she was age 70, what she could do is she could take that $1 million, roll it into her IRA. And that would be treated the exact same as if it's her IRA. And what that would mean is she wouldn't have to take out a nickel until she's 70.
Right.
Then when she's 70, she would have to take distributions. But instead of having, a factor of 16, which might be her life expectancy at age 70, because it is a marital IRA and it's rolled into her IRA, her factor would be 26. So she would have to take less than 4%, where if you weren't married, she would have to take a much higher number.
All in 5 years.
In 5 years if that law passes. But even if that law passes, if she is married, she will then be protected. So this will be enormous. Now, again, I don't have the exact numbers for your situation, but here's the numbers in the article that shows the difference between if you don't get married and you do get married under current law, and this would be the difference to her. And the difference, believe it or not, over her lifetime would be $2 million, leaving $1 million IRA. So the the difference is just enormous. And again, that's one of the reasons, getting back to the beginning of the show, that's one of the reasons I wanted to have this peer reviewed, because if I'm you, I'm thinking, well, who the hell is Jim Lang, and how do I know that these numbers are right?
Uh-huh.
All right.
Well, I was wondering this sounds almost too, it just sounds amazing. The difference between being married and not married. And this is if I have $1 million in assets. And is that, when you said there's a $2 million difference, did you mean if I die very early?
Yeah, that's assuming that you're dying early.
And if I die, if we die around the same time, I guess it doesn't make that much difference at all.
Well, all right. So let's take that example.
Okay.
That you either die at the same time, or either one, that you die, you leave your money to Marie, and then she leaves it to, and who is her beneficiary?
She has children.
All right. So let's assume that she wants to leave that money to her children. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And there's two possible ways to do it. One, you get married, she rolls the money into her IRA, and then at her death, she leaves that money to her children.
Oh.
That is treated significantly differently than if you don't get married.
Right.
You die, she takes that money as an inherited IRA. Even under the current law, where she can take it out slowly, when she dies, then her kids are going to have to take it out very quickly.
If we're not married.
If you're not married. If you are married, then her kids will be able to take it out much more slowly. Now, if I go back to that article again, the difference between, let's say this is her kid's situation. So I have married parents versus unmarried parents. And if her kids live until their 80s, the difference on that, now this is astounding, is actually, I can't even believe it myself, but it's true, it is over $5 million difference to her kids.
I'm writing down what you're saying because it is almost too, it's almost unbelievable.
Right.
How many million did you say?
It's going to be a difference of over $5 million with current law.
Okay.
All right, now under the proposed law, if that passes, then we're probably looking at a difference of about $2
million. I see.
All right, now by the way, at the risk of sounding self-serving for a moment, David did offer, anybody that wants can get a hold of either the links, or if you're not really an internet type person, we will send you hard copies of these articles. So if you were to call Amanda at area code 412-521-2732, again, that's Amanda at 412 521-2732. She will send you all this information.
And you're just giving that away for free.
I am.
Like this radio show.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, we do have a national following. And interestingly enough, we get more calls from outside Pittsburgh than Pittsburgh, even though it airs locally and it also airs on the internet. But yeah, that offer would go to anybody.
Well, that's how I got this number over the internet, and I see where it says there's links to the article, so I can get those that way. I really appreciate this. I'm going to look into those articles, and Marie and I have some talking to do, don't we?
Do we have wedding bells in the future here? Is it?
Again, I'm going to get back to the issue. You said Marie is your lifelong committed partner. It's not like she's your buddy that you see on the weekends.
That's right.
So my thinking is, why would she not want to have this financial security for herself? And if she is concerned about her kids and who today isn't, why would she not want to take advantage of, again, a ton of money? Now, you might not have $1 million. You might have $500,000, in which case the numbers and the advantages that I told you would just have to be cut in half. But whatever you have, it still is very, very substantial.
It sounds
that
like
is the
it. Well,
that is the difference.
I sure appreciate all this information and all the time that you've spent with me. I will do some further reading.
Well, so you've
been
very
much for your time.
Well, normally we have a guest on this show, and we didn't have one today, and so you have in effect been that guest, and I thank you for your time.
Good luck to you.
All right. Thanks again, John.
Jim, in helping John through his situation, you were talking about all the advantages of being married. Are there any disadvantages?
Well, sure. I mean, obviously, John has a unique set of facts and circumstances like we all do. Also, John and his partner are in their 60s. For a younger couple, Social Security is not really a factor in their short-term planning. Estate planning might not be as important to them. So then you have to look at some of the other advantages and disadvantages. So for example, depending on their situation, there can be an income tax bonus, if you will, or an income tax penalty. There's a famous marriage penalty that typically is when you have two people earning roughly the same amount of money. The taxes and the income taxes on being married could be higher than if they stayed single. So for younger people with roughly equal earnings records, it might not be so good to get married. Another situation that we ran into in practice is under Obamacare, you can get some pretty cheap health insurance if your income is low. So let's say you have a low income. Let's say your partner has a high income. If you are single, you will qualify for pretty cheap health insurance based on your income. If, on the other hand, you are married, they will combine your income with your spouse's income, and then you'll find that the cost of your health insurance goes up substantially. Now, depending on your age and how important that is, that's pretty tricky. So, for example, we have one couple. And the plan there is to get married when the financially dependent spouse is 65 and will qualify for Medicare. But before 65, they are not going to get married, so he can qualify for the lowest insurance rate. And assuming that his spouse doesn't die before then, it's going to work out. Now, the spouse in that case actually does have a big IRA. And if he does die before then it's not going to work out. So you sometimes have to look at each situation. But frankly, my typical audience, I'm usually not doing work for people in their 30s where estate planning is not really an important consideration. Typically, I'm in front of people in their 60s and older where Social Security is important. And also estate planning is important. One other thing I will mention about the Social Security. Again, the analysis that I did is peer-reviewed. But in addition, we've actually had 4 radio shows on Social Security. And every one of the guests, and we've had Jane Bryan Quinn, who is just a wonderful financial wizard, and we've had Mary Beth Franklin, and we had Kathleen Sindel, and then we had Larry Kotlikoff. From what I can tell and from those shows, I think that they would agree with, I think, just about everything that we have said today. And actually, Jane Bryan Quinn looks at it as a woman's issue. She thinks if the man takes Social Security, well, I'm being sexist again, but if she thinks that the spouse with the higher earnings record, let's assume it's the man, takes Social Security at 62, and then he dies, and his wife is doomed to have a lower record and a lower Social Security benefit for the rest of her life, that he is really doing her a great disservice by taking Social Security. Now, the last caller, John, I really want him to get married because, A, they will have more money together if they get married and he takes my advice and does the apply and suspend. But, B, if he dies early, there will be additional monies for her. Now, the extreme would be is if she didn't have a strong earnings record herself, then he is actually providing, in effect, significant financial security for her. But if you go back to the disadvantages, the other thing that I do have to admit, another disadvantage is there is some potential liability with long-term care. So certain assets that you might have that would be protected in the event that your spouse needed care.
If you were single.
If you were single and they would not force you to pay it. On the other hand, if you're talking about your lifetime partner and your partner needs care, I personally don't want your partner to be a ward of the state. And I would rather have either that covered with insurance, and I'm not necessarily a great fan of long-term care insurance, but I do think that the significant advantages in most cases, particularly when you're older and there's some money involved, and the older you are and probably the more money that's involved, the greater the benefits, is in general being married is a great thing for financial purposes. And that doesn't even include the issues of, you know, one house instead of two, traveling together on vacations, reduced food costs.
Making medical decisions.
Medical decisions and all that stuff.
Right.